This podcast is brought to you by Knowledge at Wharton.
Welcome to the Knowledge at Wharton podcast. I'm Deborah Yao, a senior editor at Knowledge at Wharton, the online management journal of the Wharton School. I'm here today with Andrea Contigiani to talk about his latest research into startups and experimentation. Companies like to do market experimentation because then they can incorporate customer feedback into their products to make them better. We hear about beta versions of software, for example, being released by companies like Microsoft or Google. But there is a trade-off. Companies learn from experimenting by releasing an early version of their products to consumers and getting their feedback, but they also risk a competitor copying their product. Andrea's research looks into this issue. His research paper is titled Experimentation, Learning, and Appropriability in Early Stage Ventures. Welcome, Andrea.
Thank you very much.
Why did you choose this particular topic?
So I've been always interested in questions around innovation. And so when I was choosing a topic for my dissertation, I wanted to find something that would be really sort of impactful that practitioners and industry people would care about. So what I did, I went out and tried to interview as many people as I could, both in the, you know, big Wharton alumni community and also in the Philadelphia sort of startup scene. And I tried to get a sense of what people doing startups cared most about. And it was really clear that many, many people, or most people, cared a lot about lean startup. Things like experimenting, your minimum viable product, pivoting. These were some of the things that really came up most. And I obviously was very familiar with lean, but I wasn't, I don't think I was fully aware of the impact that it had on business and entrepreneurship. And I mean, I think lean has really been a little bit of a revolution. The U.S. government is even asking the companies they fund to use the lean startup methodology through a program called iCORE. I mean, lean, the keywords of lean have really become part of the business language in all sectors, not just in startups. And so this has really been an important change. And so I wanted to look into this topic with data.
Great. And so just to back up a little bit, you mentioned lean startup. Can you explain real briefly what that is for our listeners?
Absolutely. So the lean startup is really, at this point, not just a set of tools. It's more of a, in my view, a way to do business. And in particular, it applies to early stage companies. But in reality, it applies to everyone doing innovation, including large firms, possibly including nonprofits, even governments. The core of the lean startup is essentially experimentation. Rather than trying to understand the details of your business, of your product, before executing, the idea is to try to have an idea of your business and then get market feedback as soon as possible. And that's really what we call experimentation. There are some specific practical tools that the lean startup suggests. In my view, primarily minimum viable product and pivoting. These are really the two big innovations in there. And in general, you know, this really helps companies innovate more effectively. I think it's really important to mention that now we all use this terminology. There's a lot of authors, researchers, practitioners talking about it. Much of the lean startup really comes from the amazing work that Steve Blank and Eric Ries have done over the past 10, 15 years. And I attended the Lean Startup Conference last year, 2017, in San Francisco, where Eric presented his latest book, The Startup Way. And this has been really, really interesting because from the kind of the big change from his previous book, 2011, the Lean Startup, maybe the classic of this line of thought, is that now the Startup Way tries to really teach how to do lean innovation to all kinds of firms, not just startups. And it's been, I think, a fundamental change in business.
So I understand that your research actually takes that and goes a step further. Walk us through what the goal of your research is and what are some of the parameters for your study.
So that's exactly what I'm hoping to do with my research. Try to really understand. I think this is an extraordinarily valuable set of ideas. Now, as a researcher, what I do, I try to take these ideas to the data and see what the data say about them. And of course, while I really believe that the lean has some fundamental value, there are probably some what we would call in research boundary conditions. That could be situations where going lean is optimal, and other situations where it's not. And maybe in those situations, if you want to go lean, you have to also take some other strategies to kind of make that work. And so I wanted to try to understand those boundary conditions. And the first step I took, which is what I do with this specific study, but this is only the first step of the first of many steps, I look at a very important concept that in the innovation academic literature has been discussed for a long time, which is the idea of appropriability. We'll talk about that shortly, but I try to look at the role of appropriability in experimentation. And the way I do that, I exploit for empirical purposes a very, very interesting change in the intellectual property environment in the U.S., which is a U.S. Supreme Court decision that took place in 2014 named Alice Corp versus CLS Bank International. This has been a little bit of an important institutional change because it really, let's say, changed the way we think about patents in part of the software industry. And so in some sense is what in research we call a quasi-natural experiment. It affected some companies doing software, but not all companies doing software. And so what it did really changed appropriability for some of the companies. And so using that, studying what companies did in that context helps us understand how appropriability plays out in experimentation.
And can you just, for our listeners' sake, can you just explain what you mean by appropriability? And also, you mentioned in your paper the terms formal intellectual property and informal intellectual property.
I would argue appropriability is one of the most important concepts that we have in the innovation academic literature. In my view, it really comes out of the work that David Tees did, a very well-known strategy scholar from UC Berkeley, and certainly, a lot of work before and after contribute to that. The idea of appropriability is essentially the capacity that a firm has to appropriate value from its invention. So if you're an innovator, large firm, small firm, inventor, doesn't matter, when you create an innovation, the value of that could go to you or to other players in the market, depending on how the market is structured and on the strategy that you take and how other companies react. So appropriability is essentially how much of the value you can keep for yourself, how much you can appropriate. Now, I thought that this could be an important boundary condition for experimentation, so more broadly for going lean. And so the basic hypothesis, in the data things are much more nuanced, but the basic hypothesis would be that when a probability is not high, and so you're not clearly able to appropriate most of the value of your innovation because you have some kind of defenses in place, when you experiment, you're giving out some of the information, some information about your product at a time in which you're still, in some sense, vulnerable. And so you can get imitated, you can get replicated. And so those processes reduce the appropriability. So in some sense, the point is that experimentation, if you don't have an appropriate defensive strategy, might reduce your appropriability. Now, what defines how much appropriability there is? And of course, a fundamental role is played by what we call intellectual property. or you know, some people would even say, well, IP is what defines a probability. So these are really, in some sense, the same concept. And there are, you know, some recent work, actually, there's some classic work, in particular work by Cohen and others in the early 2000s, but also some recent work by Hall and colleagues clearly explains how there are two important forms of intellectual property. One is what we call formal intellectual property. So the legal tools that you have to protect your intellectual properties, those are clearly patents, trademarks, copyrights, to some extent, trade secrecy. Even if somebody would say, well, trade secrecy is really not necessarily a formal tool, it's more of an informal tool, somewhere in between, although it is regulated by specific law. And on the other hand, you have informal intellectual property, which is instead a set of strategic tools, a set of strategic moves that you can take to protect your innovation. The strategy literature, which I, in some sense, I hope to be part of, is really focused on this. You know, things like having a complex product, lead times, and going to market early and try to build some switching costs, some barriers to imitation. These are important forms of IIP, informal intellectual property. Now, what I try to really understand in the paper is, okay, when formal intellectual property becomes less strong or less effective, then you might switch and try to use informal intellectual property. So this is one of the aspects of the study.
So what are your main takeaways from your research? Like, how can startups take what you've found and apply them practically to their business?
Absolutely. So I basically collected, hand-collected data about product development processes of 1,200 software startups. And what I did, I tried to see from online sources, tech magazines, social media, and so on. And so through that, I wanted to understand when they were testing or experimenting and when they were essentially launching their products, and in some sense, when they actually entered the market. And so I wanted to see how these choices, so maybe how the overall strategy of these companies changed when this court decision, Alice, took place. Because what the court decision did, it essentially made patenting and so formal intellectual property much harder for some companies. So what I find two things, broadly speaking. One is that when Alice takes place, the affected companies really change strategy. And in particular, they seem to be less likely to test their product. They do less experimentation. And the idea is that, of course, given that they can no longer use patents to protect, that experimentation becomes risky. And so, sure, you get the benefit of learning, but then the cost of doing so goes up. So it's not necessarily a good idea. On the other hand, what they do, they instead seem to launch their product faster. So in that sense, they want to go to market because so they can start getting their feedback. Adapting your product, so maybe pivoting, once you're in the market, is a little harder than before because what we would call adaptation costs are higher. But on the other hand, once you do that, you're essentially creating other barriers to imitation, like brand, like network effects. And so it is safer. So this is kind of the first result. Companies tend to experiment less, but they go to market faster. The second result is more about performance. And there I try to look at what happens to companies that do a lot of experimentation while they're in the new post-Alice regime, and so where they cannot really protect through patents. And I do see that there is a negative correlation between doing that and performance. Companies that do that, so that experiment a lot without the potential access to patent protection, seem to be less likely to get funding. And they also seem less likely to get acquired. And so overall, this choice seems to really affect the performance. These are kind of, in some sense, the research findings. Let me give you a little bit of the practical implications of what I think are the practical implications of this. Well, the first implication is for startups, of course, is that, it's really important, especially in you know, very uncertain markets, that you learn, that you get customer feedback. But when you choose that strategy, you really have to take into account how you can protect your invention. And so patents is what I focus on in the study. There are other ways, and so, you know, there could be other ways, but again, it's really important to keep an eye on intellectual property and appropriability, because that can really hurt you if you don't do that. And I would say that my sense by talking to entrepreneurs is that they really focused on learning, less so on appropriability. And so that is something that I think the data suggests people should keep an eye on. There are also, I think, implications for other players in the economy. So I'll briefly talk about those. I think this matters to investors. In some sense, investors seem to be really aware of this trade-off, because I see that companies that don't seem to worry about a probability get less funding. And so investors probably are very aware about this. Although, again, I think there is really an interesting takeaway for them, because if you invest in companies that really need a lot of learning, because maybe they're building something very new, very novel, you know, maybe they're doing something that researchers will call a radical innovation, a disruptive innovation. Well, in that case, you might need a lot of experimentation. But also, in that case, well, you might need to protect yourself through IP effectively. And so this is really something that investors should keep an eye on, because obviously making investment decisions on their own companies can be painful. Broadly, I want to end with implications for policy, because that might matter as well. You know, policymakers obviously care a lot about innovation. Now, if, you know, in important markets or subsectors of the economy, it is really hard to protect through IP, then what companies might do, well, first of all, they might be less likely to succeed, because in those sectors, experimentation is really, really important. Market feedback is very, very important. And so if you can't really experiment properly, that might be hard to do. And on the other hand, companies may even realize that actually it's hard to get into, you know, to try to build those innovative products without being able to safely experiment. So they might even choose to switch and try to actually compete in more traditional markets. And that would mean less innovation for the economy.
So what sets your research apart from prior work in this area?
Oh, so that's a nice question. What I'm trying to do really is to really understand this idea of experimentation, and more broadly, you know, in some sense, understanding the lean methodology, which I think it's a really fundamental innovation of this past decade. Now, there are a few other researchers around the world doing research on this. I like to think that at least I try to differentiate my work in a couple of ways. One, I would say, is that I put together a really detailed data set of how companies test, when companies launch, how companies do afterwards. And this has been a lot of work, I think. And this is something that I think sets my research apart. Most other studies on this use very small data sets, or mostly they look at case studies. And it's those approaches have very important advantages as well, but obviously it's hard to do statistical inference without a large sample. So putting together this large sample was a big effort. I really want to mention I worked with an amazing team of research assistants that were partly Wharton undergrads and partly people around the world that I hired through Upwork, and they helped me so much to put this data together. I would also mention a couple of other things that are more academic, and in some sense, I think, you know, have some value for research. One is that I haven't seen much other work trying to examine or try to use in research this Supreme Court decision, Alice. And that's been such an important event that I think research should really look at it. And at least in my area, I think this is the first study that does that. And also, finally, there are two important streams of research in management and strategy. One is the research on organizational learning. One is the research on appropriability. In some sense, they look at two sides of this trade-off around experimentation. And in my understanding, these literatures haven't really been combined too much. So what my work does tries to connect them.
So how will you follow up this research? What's next?
So the next, well, there's lots of next steps. I definitely want to keep going and understand a little more of what are the boundary conditions of experimentation in startups primarily, but maybe also in large firms and to some extent in governments and policy. So at all these levels, people innovate, and maybe we can try to see how experimentation plays out if that and when that makes innovation better and more effective at any of these levels. There's a couple of things that I really want to work on soon. There are at least two other boundary conditions of experimentation that I think we need to think about. One is reputation. So when you go to market very early with a minimum viable product, with an early stage product, with a prototype, that's super helpful because it helps you get market feedback and learn. On the other hand, if the feedback is negative, while useful because you can pivot early on, that feedback might affect your reputation. And so those reputational concerns don't really seem to be, I don't know, it doesn't seem to me that entrepreneurs, maybe even investors, consider them carefully. And so I really want to go to the data and see how they play out. There was a really nice study by Chatterjee from Duke University and Tolfa from Harvard University a few years ago that looked at how rating systems affect the way companies behave and strategize. And I think rating systems is a really nice empirical tool to measure reputation. And so one of the things I want to do, I want to see how experimentation plays out in some sectors where rating systems are more or less strong or more or less organized to try to understand the reputational concerns of experimentation. The second piece is really looking instead at the learning process itself. You know, experimentation makes you learn, but may have these other costs like imitation or reputation. But actually, let's think about learning itself, which to some extent is the most fundamental piece here. Now, there's a lot of research in strategy that shows that learning is hard to do, right? You can get information, but you not necessarily learn the right thing because there are many types of biases which arise both at the individual level, you know, people learn in different ways, and at the collective level, at the team level. And that depends on the structure of the team, on the experience of the team, on how the team works together. So I think we need to look at the learning process and see how we can make that work optimally to make experimentation work well.
So we'll leave it right there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
You can find more insights from Knowledge at Wharton on our website, knowledge.wharton.upenn.edu. You can also find all of our podcasts on iTunes, and we welcome your reviews.
For more insight from Knowledge at Wharton, please visit knowledge.wharton.upenn.edu.